Welcome to Farced Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
I'm Pete.
I'm Ben, his co-host, and welcome back to The Henson Perspective, where we look back 45 years ago at the original New York City broadcasts of episodes of The Muppet Show. 45 years ago today was February 14th, 1977, and as a lovely Valentine's Day to America, they were gifted with the presence of Phyllis Diller.
We sure were.
Of course, it wasn't recorded then.
No.
It had been produced in October of the previous year, from the 11th to the 14th, and there's absolutely hardly anything romantically themed about the episode, although there's a tinge, a frisson of feminine beauty and relationships strewn throughout the guest star and the backstage appearances.
But while this aired on February 14th in America, it aired in the UK on December 5th, so...
So they wanted to keep it open-ended in that regard.
Yeah.
It wasn't sweeps week programming.
No.
It wasn't modern day lockstep with the calendar. Well, I say modern day. By modern day, I mean the 90s. Nowadays, nothing has any air dates. It's all direct to streaming and massive dumps. And so you can't have anything that has that kind of themed calendar-based stuff going on, because who knows when someone else is going
to
watch it.
Yeah, but they tend to theme it based off of when it dumps.
You're thinking of Hawkeye.
Yeah.
With the way in which that was a Christmas show. That's really the only one I can think of recently where they had what was going on with the dump match up with the season.
I feel like there's others that are similarly themed, but I can't think of any examples right now.
The other thing that's contemporary to when we're recording this, but probably won't be to when we broadcast it, is, hey, Pete, should we take our podcast off of Spotify with everybody else?
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Okay, so if you're the six or seven people who listen to this on Spotify, if you suddenly discover that it is no longer available, this was why.
Cancel your Spotify's because of us and tell them that, and maybe they'll pay us to come back.
If we ever end up with a Ko-fi or a coffee or a however it's pronounced account where we're asking for donations, then I'll have done something wrong. This is supposed to be a loss. This is supposed to be just bad money after good.
I'm in for the cash, baby. Give me that sweet, sweet cash.
And you need to start dropping references to various things that sponsor other podcasts and hope that they'll take it as an opportunity for, oh, he's willing to talk about us. Maybe they'll do ads.
I'll do anything.
Listener, we will not do ads. Pete will do many things. I will maintain the economic purity of this podcast.
I'm a semi-professional comedian and a semi-professional podcaster.
Really?
No, but I'm willing to be.
Fair.
Well,
fair,
wait. Fair. If those six listeners are paying for Spotify,
yes,
and listening to us there, then they are paying to listen to us with some of their money. We're not seeing any of that money, so therefore, we are semi-professional podcasters.
I don't think that's how going pro works, is that other people make money and you don't. And I don't think it works that, like, if the money gets halfway to us and stops, that makes us semi-pro either.
Well, that's my whole definition for why I'm a semi-professional comedian. I have performed for paying audiences, but I myself have not been paid.
Understood. Well, speaking of semi-professional comedians, one of the big runners with this guest is that she is a fully professional comedian, and that Fozzie is exceptionally excited to have her on the show, that he might be able to learn some comic chops for her.
That starts in the opening when he doesn't even finish his joke.
It's true. In the opening, after Kermit says her name with no particular verve or reaction.
No fanfare whatsoever.
He backs out of the O, doesn't say ooh, doesn't say woo, continues to not do that when he introduces her for real after Fozzie's joke. But Fozzie's joke in this is pretty great.
Did you hear the one about the kangaroo who walked into a store and this hippopotamus comes out and says to the kangaroo, hey, I wasn't thinking it?
Yeah, it pretty great in the sense that he doesn't tell a joke.
It's great in that I laugh.
Oh, yeah. No, what happens is funny, but he doesn't tell a joke.
You know, there are two classic ways of telling non-jokes, one of which is you end with a punchline and you have to imagine what the joke was. Mm-hmm. But the other is to come up with a premise that could never live up to any conclusion. How do you think about Fozzie's opener to this non-joke?
Oh, I wanted to see where it happened, but then when Kermit crashed the stage, then it was even funnier.
And then at the end of the introduction, as Gonzo wheels back to hit the O, Crazy Harry pops up and hits his plunger, and there's a explosion.
First explosion of the episode.
Lousy explosion, Pete.
Oh, they're all lousy explosions.
No. Because when we get to Dr. Bunsen Honeydew later, we're going to have some great explosions. But this explosion has no effect whatsoever. There's an explosion, there's no soot, there's no damage, there's nothing that gives us any indication that this was a real explosion.
Besides the puff of smoke and flash.
After that, we have people standing there totally unaffected by it.
Yeah, but it's still an explosion.
Look, I get that for your ability to count, these are things that you just get to say another number and that makes you happy. Whereas I want things that have weight, that have effect on the world.
You want both Gonzo and Crazy Harry to have been eviscerated by shrapnel, because that's the only other outcome if that bomb went off right there.
I think it's been very clear in past Muppet explosions that they're basically Looney Tunes cartoon characters, that they wipe the soot off their eyes and blink, and then they're back to normal. What I want is I want there to have been a sense that something happened.
Okay.
The O to have cracked.
Them to have reacted at all other than just...
Yeah.
Yeah, because they do look fairly dead-faced at the camera after it happens.
Right. You consistently watch the show with subtitles.
Mm-hmm.
Did your subtitles tell you what Gonzo said after the explosion?
I don't remember, so therefore I don't think so.
He says one word, and I watched it a couple of times to try and figure out if maybe he was saying cute. Because it had that kind of a reaction to it, but I couldn't tell what he was saying.
Nope, I got nothing.
Good enough. Fozzie then storms in front of the curtain to take over the show. He's so enthusiastic about this. He's totally unfazed by his failure to tell the joke in the opening, but he is running command on this set in order to introduce
our super extra special guest star,
Miss Phyllis Diller.
Mm-hmm.
Kermit is perturbed by the fact that Fozzie decided to just take over the show on his own volition and guides him to a space on the stage where he can pull a trap door, dumping Fozzie into the unknown depths below the stage. Frank's trap door yell is wonderful.
It truly is. It's not the best trap door yell of the episode.
Interesting. And then Kermit introduces the first musical number by the Gogolala Jubilee Jug Band, which is Mississippi Mud. Pete, when the Muppets have shown their legs and feet in the past, you have been creeped out by it. How did you feel about three down-home cornpone Muppets with their feet in actual, literal, wet, squidgy mud?
It was gross, and I'm surprised the internet hasn't found this earlier and gone wild for it.
Maybe they don't like those kind of feet. They were very strangely animated. The feet were foam rubber, or perhaps plush, and there was no real ankle. So there was clearly a stiff rod through the shin that terminated at the heel, and then the foot extended out would just flop.
Yeah.
So that you would have a nice solid push into the mud from the leg, and then the foot would land however it landed in the mud as it did so. As these three Muppets chair danced on the side of a crick or something.
It was gross, and I also really enjoyed how you could see the control arms for the Muppet on the far right of the screen.
It must have been a huge number of puppeteers, because the middle Muppet didn't have arms that could move, but the Muppets on either side of him were both clapping and stomping and moving their heads and singing.
The sun goes down, the tide goes down, the people gather around and they all begin to shout. Hey, hey, Uncle Doug, it's the Beachy Beach Beat on the Mississippi Mud, it's the Beachy Beach Beat on the Mississippi Mud.
So I'm guessing probably three puppeteers per Muppet.
Yeah, one on legs, one on arms, one on head. Or maybe two, one on head and then one on arms and feet, so that way they could get the choreography easier.
Could be. I think you would probably need to do each leg independently in order to get the legs to move up and down. So I that feels like a two-arm job to me to do both legs, but I don't know.
Yeah, it was really well choreographed. It was good.
A little bit about the song. It was first performed in 1928 by Irene Taylor and Paul Whitehouse's Rhythm Boys. And the only reason that's particularly interesting is that Bing Crosby was one of Paul Whitehouse's Rhythm Boys. So he was the original tenor voice of the chorus of this song. This song is also distressingly racist in its original version. The lyric that we have here in The Muppet Show is, "The people beat their feet in the Mississippi mud." That is not the original lyric.
Oof.
It is a term for an American black enslaved person that specifically refers to the darkness of their skin. And I was kind of shocked to hear the 1928 recording and hear that word come out at me. I shouldn't have been.
Nope.
It makes sense. But it also put a whole additional color on the song to me. This song is about people enjoying watching black people sing and dance. This is a song about appreciating minstrel shows.
Mm-hmm.
And I had found it to be sort of an enjoyable little romp. It's on the Muppet Show album. It's a song, therefore, I know basically by heart. And those original lyrics very much have made me feel icky about the whole thing.
Well, thanks for making our audience and now me also feel icky about enjoying it.
Look, complicity is required.
I appreciate it. I just hope you get the joy you so well deserve out of ruining it for all of us.
I hope so, yes. As the song is over, we cut to backstage.
Nope, we get a Statler and Waldorf first.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
Because it's a good one.
Yes, because Statler loves this performance.
Yeah, he's saying bravo a bunch, but he's facing the wrong way. He's AC Slatering his chair.
How would you know? You're not even facing the stage.
Why did you have to tell me I was having such a good time?
Good bit.
The reason I wanted to hustle to the backstage section is because you have in the past said that there was a particular member of the Gogolala Jubilee Jug Band that you liked.
The jug player.
And he wasn't in Mississippi Mud.
No, but the whole jug band came off stage.
That's right. The jug player and the flaxen blonde girl that's part of the group and the three performers all walk on into the backstage bit. Did you feel like you had been ripped off by not getting some serious blind jug action?
I mean, I do always enjoy the jug player and his jug playing skills, but no, because it was still fine.
This has Scooter introducing the runner for the episode. He compliments the jug band players. He says that their number was very believable, which I thought was an odd descriptor.
Well, he says that, and then shortly thereafter, he realizes that they didn't wipe their feet, and he goes chasing after them. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what the believable was referring to, was
that they were actually in the
mud.
Yeah,
and then he realizes that, and realizes that they're tracking mud everywhere.
Hilda starts talking about the guest,
mm-hmm.
that she's wonderful, so young-looking, and raises the question as to whether or not she's had plastic surgery.
Not whether she has or not. She applauds Phyllis for being so open about having gotten plastic surgery.
Well, it's Scooter who says that she talks about it all the time in her act.
Oh,
whereas
okay.
Hilda asks,
"Just between you and me, do you suppose Miss Diller has had her face raised?"
Oh, you mean lifted? Oh, sure, yeah, she jokes about it all the time.
And as somebody who knows very little about Phyllis Diller, I wasn't sure. I had to take this as read, that this was, in fact, something that she'd talked a lot about. But it felt like one of those things that I knew in the way back of my mind. You know, that she made husband jokes and that she talked about aging less than gracefully. Fighting against aging over time.
Yeah, it's not in the quiz, but she did receive either a Lifetime Achievement Award or some other award from the Plastic Surgery Association for helping bring plastic surgery out of the shameful closet because she was so open about all the work she had done.
And the nub of this is that Hilda says, well, if Phil Stiller is so open about this, maybe she should look into it. After all, she's 35, and so maybe she needs to start reclaiming the glow of her youth.
This hurt.
How old did you turn your last birthday, Peter?
38. But also, it was 1977. Wilford Brimley was 52 in Cocoon.
It's true. 58 was a whole different level of achievement.
Yeah. So I guess in 76, 35 was 52. And in 82, I think, is that's when Cocoon came out. If Wilford Brimley was 52, then he was really 76. So yeah, it tracks. The math tracks.
the sketch ends with Scooter conferring with Fozzie to say, wait, is it really possible that our vintage gray-haired costume lady is only 35? And Fozzie says, yeah, definitely, but only around the waist.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. I put that joke out of my mind because I was like, ew, gross.
So that was my reaction the first two times I watched this. But, and we'll talk about her act later, but once I was rewatching Phyllis's segment with Rolf at the piano, I realized that felt like a Phyllis Diller joke, what Fozzie and Scooter were doing. It doesn't come across the same way. When you have Fozzie and Scooter making that joke and then looking down the barrel of the camera and laughing at it, it feels ugly.
Yeah, because Phyllis is being self-depreciating. That's fine. You can say terrible things about your own body, but for a bear to say it about Hilda's body is just not great.
And I thought that that was interesting, is that I really do think that's probably a Phyllis Diller joke or a Phyllis Diller-esque joke, and that they therefore were like, hey, we're in on the joke, except they shouldn't have tried to be. And that they then had the canned audience appreciate it didn't work.
We'll talk about more jokes that don't work later.
That then proceeds to Kermit introducing the segment with Rolf and Phyllis doing a bunch of jokes together, so we'll come back to that.
Then after that, we have another Statler and Waldorf, where they thought that the sketch that we're not talking about right now was very funny, but they've forgotten who the guest star is.
What's her secret?
What's her magic?
What's her name?
You've forgotten too, huh?
Well, whoever she is, she's every bit as funny as Phyllis Diller.
Then we go backstage once again, where Hilda takes a step out of the dressing room to make sure that no one's there, and then goes back in and comes back out with her hair changed to be longer, straighter, colored, reddish, I believe. And she says that no one's certain to recognize her now, and Kermit walks up to her and recognizes her instantly, doesn't even acknowledge her hair is different. And Hilda is miffed and pulls off her wig.
After that, we have the Muppet News Flash. Unlike our previous couple of news flashes, which were straight, no guest appearances, this one did have Phyllis in it, so we will talk about it anon. And after that, we have At the Dance,
which starts off with George and Mildred together dancing. No Pogo George.
No, very much not. Mildred is doing a very flamboyant neck-back twirl. She's clearly having the time of her life. And that is sort of the first joke of the At the Dance, because there are only four jokes. And so the first moment is just how much fun they're having on the dance floor.
Mm-hmm.
The second joke, or the first true verbal joke, is two pigs, each talking about how much they love each other, so much so that it's destabilizing them. I can't see straight, I can't eat, I can't sleep. And Zoot randomly walks by and says, you two need to check into a hospital, man.
Barely a joke.
It's in construction, yes, but in terms of the impulse to comment on the fact that our feelings of ardor are often expressed as things that would ordinarily make us say, oh, that's not a good thing to be?
Yes, I agree with you. It is constructed as a joke.
Statler and Waldorf are dancing again together, where they had previously danced in the Twiggy episode. Except that is three production episodes later.
Yes.
So that's why in this,
they say it's good to get out of that box. I appreciate them addressing it, even though they aired it out of order.
I believe it's Waldorf who says, in response to the fact that Statler says it's good to get out of the box, quiet, I'm leading.
Yep.
Which is amusing because in the Twiggy episode, they also are arguing about who gets to lead. So it is definitely a dynamic between the two of them.
And then he 1-2-3 dips him.
I told you, it is a running thing.
Yep.
We just haven't seen where it started yet. Then we go back to George and Mildred.
Yeah, which... there is a little bit of Pogo George in this segment.
Hardly.
More so than the original twirling. He is doing an up and down motion in this one.
Okay.
And Zoot is playing the saxophone.
Zoot, yeah, continues to wander through the dance field, except whereas before he was just negging other people, now he's actually playing along to the tea music.
And Mildred realizes that that's what she doesn't like about him. He's always blowing his own horn.
The fourth and last joke is Janice is dancing with the Green Frackle. Janice normally dances with Zoot in these segments, but Zoot is apparently not participating in dancing this week. And says to the Frackle, wasn't that garlic that you had hot?
to which he opens his mouth and breathes fire.
There's no noticeable effect of the fact that he's breathing fire right next to her head, because it's a special effect that's pasted in afterwards.
Yeah.
It's done on a separate layer on top, and so they didn't actually construct a Muppet that can breathe fire. Like, they have one that produces smoke or air or various other things. We had in I've Got You Under My Skin, we had the Muppet that bat water.
Mm-hmm. But no practical fire yet.
Not so much. After At the Dance, we have the UK spot, which is Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem playing Lazy Bones.
Yep, we sure did.
I'm sad about this. I mean, I'm not surprised that you found this to be underwhelming, but I would say that this is one of two performances I can think of that I remember when I was doing my dedicated watches of The Muppet Show on Nick Jr. in college, that I remember being impressed that the show was willing to just take time to do a song with no jokes whatsoever, that was just about quality musical instrumentation, and that this song isn't doing anything comedic. It's just saying, we have great session musicians, and they're allowing them to be celebrated by having the Muppets act out their music.
Mm-hmm. And as the tried and true topic of this segment or section or every time this comes up, I agree. Those session musicians are very talented, but the Muppets portraying it, not doing a great job.
In the past, you've talked about the fact that one of the reasons you don't like the Dr. Teeth performances is that you feel like Dr. Teeth is just sort of flailing around at the keyboard, as opposed to the Rolf performances, where you feel like, or you have felt like, his hands miming the piano is entertaining and you can actually see an attempt at reproducing the musicality. This starts with very good Dr. Teeth hands.
Mm-hmm.
And so it should have at least partially won you over in saying, we're trying to do something more than the normal long-armed shimmy shake that he does.
I did appreciate that. And the editing and wipes were also very good and engaging. And I don't know why I'm fine with Zoot playing the saxophone.
Mm.
I could watch him forever. But Janice and Floyd playing their guitars, I just don't care about. And as soon as it's just them, I'm like, no, I don't care. Nothing is happening here. But I'm able to suspend my belief for Zoot. Don't know why.
The trivia track in this particular episode, weirdly enough, went out of its way to agree with you. I don't know why the timing synced up on that. But it pointed out that Dave Goles had, in interviews, talked about the fact that he felt silly miming along to the sax playing until he met a number of sax players that really appreciated his sax action and thought that he actually must have known how to play in real life because he was so good at it.
I think it's Zoot's lack of lips and the way when he grips the mouthpiece with the mouth, that those lips disappear even more.
Mm.
And so it looks like he's actually making the motion that one would make.
That pursing squeeze thing that you need to do in order to get the reed to work.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's that he breathes. You know, he'll stretch up and breathe, and then he'll tighten down around the mouthpiece again in a way that simulates what you would do to take breath and then produce more sound out of the sax.
Mm-hmm. Which we'll talk about that more later.
The song came out in 1933. It's by Hoagie Carmichael and Johnny Mercer, and it was their first collaboration. And Carmichael, in interviews, has said that he'd been traveling in Europe and came back 6 or 7 weeks after it had been released and was told that in those just under 2 months during the Great Depression, the sheet music had sold over 300,000 copies.
Wow.
And he was, in my opinion, idiotic enough to say that this was one of the reasons the arts community was able to draw themselves out of the Great Depression. I think that's a specious conclusion, but I'm also not an economist. Johnny Mercer went on to found Capitol Records. And is a hugely influential songwriter and lyricist, having done the lyrics for Moon River and a little theme song to a movie called Charade or something like that.
I've never heard it pronounced that way.
That's how it's pronounced in the song.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
I don't. It must be a movie I haven't heard of.
Or owned a number of copies of.
Can't imagine. Whereas Hoagie Carmichael also wrote the music to the well-annoying, speaking of Fur Elise the other week, Heart and Soul, which is the other song that everybody in the world can play on the piano. So much so that people thought that Carmichael must have also written Chopsticks. Going down a deep wiki hole about this song in particular was interesting to me because I was a little weirded out by the racial overtones of this song. That lyrically, it's about a person sleeping in the sun and not working, and it unfortunately has Black American post-enslaved racism built into that. And the fact that it was written by two Southern white men, I had a hard time with. And so I was trying to figure out what the genesis and what the reaction to that was. And I don't feel like I have enough from a couple of Wikipedia articles to really comment on it further than that. But linked up to the previous song, the two of them together did not mesh well.
You're 2 for 2 for ruining songs in this episode so far. Up next, we've got Talkspot, which features our special guest, Phyllis Diller. So we will return to that in a moment. But after that, we have a song called Hugga Wugga, which features a beast singing a nonsense song of the words Hugga Wugga and various other sound-alikes, while another beast sings a different song until the first beast convinces the second beast to sing Hugga Wugga with him.
Hookie wookie, hiki wookie.
Hugga Wugga.
Hugga Wugga.
Through threats of violence and angry eye-flopping.
Mm-hmm. And then a third gentle creature comes in and starts singing You're My Sunshine, making the first creature mad and beating him up until he submits, except he doesn't submit.
Yeah, there's definitely a weird message about bullying in this sketch in terms of the first creature is like, you must sing the song that I like, only the weird nonsense lyrics that I approve. And somebody singing something else will be blasted with steam out of my nose. And the proper response to that is to blast back and then sing your song of joy and friendliness.
The sound design on this whole sketch was wonderful. Mm. The effect on Frank Oz's voice, he's the original beast.
He's the bully.
And then the sound that it makes when the steam, smoke, whatever blasts out of his nose is so cool.
John Lovelady plays the second Muppet, the sort of birdie Muppet that gets bullied into singing along and then gets blasted once it joins in with You Are My Sunshine. And Jerry Nelson is the yellow friendly alien Muppet who eventually wins the day. This is a sketch that was performed at least 3 times on television prior to this.
I also saw that.
Yeah, and the original versions on The Ed Sullivan Show, on The Tonight Show, The Today Show, and...
It was actually first performed on stage in Nancy Sinatra's Las Vegas stage show, Movin' with Nancy.
No, because that was in 1971, and it appeared as early as 66 and 68 on all these other television shows.
Muppet.fandom.com, for shame.
Well, here's the thing. Being performed as Hugga Wugga the first time was on the Nancy Sinatra show. Prior to that, it was Shrap Flap.
Oh, Hugga Wugga was way better.
The designs of the Muppets were completely different. And instead of singing You Are My Sunshine, the happy little weird Muppet just came up and said Meep.
Hmm. It does look like it would say Meep. It's a Muppet that should make that noise.
It's kind of fascinating to watch the characters evolve over time. And on Jim Henson's Red Book page, where they have Jim Henson's one-line diary entries of different things that he accomplished, they have some of the sketches of the Muppets as they were finalized for the Sinatra and this production. The word Coosbane is never spoken in this, despite the fact that the background and the alien forms are very Coosbanian.
Yeah, Kermit should have been in the trench coat introducing...
this bit.
Yeah, the Hugga Wuggas.
Statler and Waldorf come on after that with Waldorf singing You Are My Sunshine, which means that Jim Henson, pretty much the only major Muppeteer who wasn't in the previous sketch, also gets to join in.
Statler's confused and thinks that he's saying he's his son, named Shine.
To which Waldorf says, "And you call me the old fool." The backstage runner has continued, and Hilda has progressed past a wig and now has been receiving beauty tips from Miss Diller, she says. She now has rhinestone glasses, lipstick, and has teased out her own hair into curls.
And she's sure that everyone will notice the change.
And when Fozzie comes on to say that it's great that there's been a change.
Yeah, she's thrilled initially, and then he says that the towels in the dressing room have been dirty for a week, and he thanks her for changing them.
Which point she gives a very Bugs Bunny-esque, well, of course, you know, this means war.
Yeah. But my question for this is, since when is changing the towels the costume department's job? That's what I would find most insulting if I was Hilda, was like, that's not even my job.
Don't you think that these professional showbiz writers and that these longtime performers would have fact-checked that and said, that's not what the costumer does, Pete?
That's true. Those writers have been working on shows for decades at this point, so they would know better than I would. A semi-professional comedian.
Either way, I'm sure Hilda has plenty to be offended about, whether it's Fozzie assuming that she's going to do his laundry for his towels in addition to his costumes.
Mm-hmm.
Or just that nobody seems to be paying attention to her beautification project. But we pause on that for now and cut to Dr. Bunsen Honeydew in Muppet Labs. A welcome return. I was pretty sure this was only the second Muppet Labs that we'd seen, but it turns out I'd forgotten one.
Oh, really? Because I also thought this was the second.
The first one, I assume you figured, was when Peter Ustinov was being the robot.
Nope, that's the one I forgot.
Which one did you remember?
The rubber table.
The tenderizer. Yeah, that's the one that I couldn't remember.
That between the two of us, we remembered the other one.
So this is the third Muppet Labs that we've seen so far. According to the trivia track, this is the final Muppet Labs of the season. But there will be one more that we'll get to.
So there were four this season.
Correct. Then. Four in season one, seven in season two, six in season three, before going back to four in season four and only three in season five.
Wow.
So my first reaction was, I can't believe there were only four in season one. That feels like such a small number. But actually, it's about average over the course of the five seasons.
Yeah. I don't have any memories of any other specifics, but like, to me, if you were to ask me what's a standard of the Muppet Show, I'd go Muppet Labs.
Right. Beaker and Honeydew. That's what you tune in for.
Yeah.
But you're right. There, aside from Beaker being blown up or threatens to be destroyed in various ways or generally being unhappy with what's going to be done to him, I don't walk around with a catalog of various Muppet Labs experiments as to what was actually done to him. Just the glee of that something's going to be done to him.
You said 4, 7, 6, 4, 2?
Three, but otherwise, three. Yes.
Okay, so there's 24 Muppets Labs. So there is essentially one season's worth of Muppet Labs and four seasons worth of no Muppets Labs.
And what is the actual average? What is 24 divided by 5?
But there were 24 times 5 is 120. So 20% of the episodes there's one on.
Look at that lightning fast stats.
I'm holding up a calculator to the camera.
Not a phone app, an actual calculator.
Yep. My mic, I was not paying attention to the sound waves. My mic might have picked up those button presses. Only our trusty editor will know the truth.
In this particular Muppet Labs, they introduced their new line of exploding hats. And this is what I was talking about earlier when I was talking about explosions having an effect. Because the first explosion of a long-burning firework that's in the hat definitely happens all in camera, with goals underneath as it's spilling sparks. And you can see Bunsen turn his head and move while all this is happening.
Today is the day we introduce our new line of exploding hats.
This isn't the traditional explosion like we got in the Svengali, where you're using it to cover up cuts.
Mm-hmm.
This is a legitimate in-camera pyrotechnic that's going on for several seconds, and it's not, therefore, potentially particularly safe. And
there's only one of these four explosions that is a camera cut.
Yeah.
the other three are real live.
But I was impressed by that, and that's one of the reasons. And the third explosion, where he says that the hat and the exploding earmuffs will join in with their perennial favorite of the Muppet Lab self-destruct necktie, that's where you have a camera cut with the explosion that leaves Honeydew with tattered, burnt clothing and a wooziness. Mm-hmm. That's, I think, the kind of comedic Acme Labs effect I was expecting from Crazy Harry in the beginning. And the fact that they did it later made me miss it all the more from the intro.
Yeah, I just like Crazy Harry blowing things up, I guess.
We have a safety curtain wipe sketch with Phyllis.
So we'll return to that shortly.
After which we have Vets Hospital.
Okay, where's the next patient?
He's right here, Dr. Bob.
Oh, little fella, isn't he? This is no patient, it's a loaf of bread.
In Animal Watch, not an animal. A loaf of bread, not an animal.
It took me a second to figure out what you were saying, because I was like, how many times has Animal been on Vets Hospital? No, you're right. Definitely not an animal.
Nope.
In Piggy Action Watch, we start with Piggy holding what I spent a little bit digging through Google image searches of surgical tools in order to figure out that this is, I believe, a retractor that would be used to pull aside tissue like a mouth or a dentist or a cut in an abdomen in order to hold it open. That she is using the curve in the wrong way to push her nose up under her mask.
Yep.
Also, Piggy has lousy mask technique.
I made this same note. That her snout is well covered, but her mouth is out in the open. Good for puppeteering, bad for preventing the spread of germs and disease.
Then again, Dr. Bob and Nurse Janice aren't wearing masks at all. So yeah. This is a very septic, potentially, operating theater.
This is also one of the shortest ones we've ever seen. Mm. It was like two jokes and then the voiceover and they got out.
Yeah, we've had another one that was about this short, but compared to the one we did a couple of weeks ago with Ben Vereen, which was the full sketch that had been on the Muppet album, mm-hmm. This one definitely feels tiny in comparison.
Also, I loved Piggy's reaction to Dr. Bob's jokes this week. Unlike the last time with the Ben Vereen one, where they could not be bothered to deal with Dr. Bob, she was loving Dr. Bob this time.
But let's mention, that's because Piggy is being played by Oz and doesn't have a lot to do. So instead, she doesn't have much in the way of jokes. She's just therefore upstaging what's going on with Henson. Frank is therefore just distracting.
Yep. Yeah, it was great. After that, we see Hilda's all-out war, which doesn't really resemble all-out war. It's just Kermit enters, sees a very attractive woman backstage, and the woman turns around, and it's Hilda in a girdle.
Well, it's Hilda in a va-va-va-voom dress with her hair down. In addition to the hair and the glasses and the lipstick, she now has added on a beauty mark, but she has packed herself into a cocktail dress, and Kermit is impressed with how slim she is. He says she's beautiful, but also asks her directly, how did you get so slim?
Then she sort of starts shaking, and then the girdle pops.
Oh, Hilda, I just want you to know that I think it's wonderful that you want to look your best and to...
And the moral of the story is that Kermit says, that's all right, Hilda, we love you just the way you are.
Yeah.
In perhaps the least convincing, very special episode delivery I've ever encountered in my life.
I really enjoyed this runner, but also was very confused by this runner, because, like I started this by saying, she just declared all-out war, and there's no evidence of any all-out war happening, other than the next step in the heightening of this whole thing.
But in terms of what you think Hilda is, for her to have gone from plain old backstage wardrobe mistress Hilda to being the soft Muppet equivalent of Jessica Rabbit, that's, I think, what she's aiming for, is that it's a total body transformation. It's pulling out all the stops in terms of getting herself to be glamorous.
Yeah.
I thought that the actual message of this, which is what they start with in the backstage runner, of Hilda saying that Phyllis talks about she feels like she should be maintaining her youth and vigor for as long as possible. And that's effectively what Kermit starts to say, too, in this. He says, you know, it's great that you want to express your youth and beauty in this way. Kermit's walking towards the point of, if this is what makes you feel good about yourself, then we support it, right before the girdle has a blowout.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's unsustainable. That's what is the moral arc of this series of jokes is, are you doing this because you want a reaction, or are you doing this because you feel good about yourself doing it? That's what Phyllis Diller is doing it for, is order to feel good about herself. That doesn't seem to be what Hilda's doing it for.
Right.
None of that lands.
No.
It's in the text, but it's not in the performance.
For sure. Next, we have basically only Phyllis Diller things besides Statler and Waldorf. We've got Phyllis's last closing number, and then the outro for the episode, and then Statler and Waldorf, which I think we should also talk about this
as a conclusion to the finale in front of the curtain.
Yes. So, let's talk about Phyllis Diller.
Excellent. I look forward to learning what I should know about Phyllis Diller.
So, I have written 5 questions for Ben about Phyllis Diller. So, Ben, question number 1. At what age did Phyllis Diller perform stand-up for the very first time? A, 17, B, 27, or C, 37?
Can I ask when Phyllis Diller was born?
July 17th, 1917.
Okay. 37.
That is correct. She was 37 years old when she performed for the first time in the basement of the Purple Onion in San Francisco on March 7th, 1955. She said that up until then she had done jokes at PTA meetings, but that was the first time she had gotten on stage. That show was a success, and she was shortly after booked for a, like, running show at a theater that was supposed to be a 2-week run that got extended to 89 weeks.
Oh my goodness.
She was an instant success, and that 89-week run got her the attention of the talk shows, and that brought her to national stardom. We haven't talked about the talk spot yet, but in the talk spot, Phyllis gave Fozzie the advice to make things up in his stand-up. In her personal life, Phyllis was married twice, first to Sherwood Anderson Diller from 1939 to 1965, and second to actor Ward Donovan Tatum from 1965 to 1975. But in her act, she had a fictional husband. What was his name in her act?
I'm afraid I know this.
Well,
this is one of the few things that I know about Phyllis Diller, is that she always referred to her husband as Fang.
Nailed it. Without even needing the fake answers that I wrote.
Well, it's also in the act that she does with Fozzie. She refers to him by name.
Oh, does she? I didn't...
Yep.
Maybe that's because I didn't know this when I watched the episode the first 2 times. So I was just like, moving on. Well, congrats on that gimme. Another thing that we haven't yet talked about, but I wrote a question talking about specifically, is that we see Phyllis play the saxophone very badly. But in reality, she was a very accomplished musician. She performed what instrument with 100 symphony orchestras around the United States?
Oh my goodness.
Piano, saxophone, or violin?
Ooh. The question is, did she know how to play saxophone well enough that she knew how to play it badly in this episode? Piano.
That is correct. She was a soloist in those performances. She was also a self-taught artist. She began painting in 1963 and worked with oils, watercolors, and acrylics. This one is not going well for my score. Question number 4. In the early 1960s, Phyllis Diller performed in Greenwich, Connecticut, where what, at the time up-and-comer, but future superstar, opened for her? Is it A, Barbra Streisand, B, Carol Burnett, or C, Joan Rivers?
Joan Rivers.
Barbra Streisand, Babs opened for Phyllis Diller. I have no subsequent facts about this being interesting. I was just, this was one of those things I went, wait, what? Like, someone got to see that show and later on in life was like, oh yeah, yeah, I guess I saw Babs open for Phyllis. That's pretty cool. Question number 5. After Phyllis's death, the New York Times wrote a remembrance of her, and which of the following was not listed as someone who has echoed something from Diller's act in their own? Eddie Murphy, Joan Rivers, or Lady Gaga?
I'm going to do Rivers again.
That is correct. Joan Rivers has not, according to this article, taken something from Phyllis's act. Eddie Murphy, they drew a parallel between his loud laugh after his punchlines to something that Phyllis Diller did to let the audience know that she was in on the joke. Mm. And they drew the parallel between Lady Gaga's dresses and Phyllis's way of dressing in big, loud dresses to, again, draw the audience attention. So, yeah, you got 4 out of 5 correct. I'm never going to catch up. So now that we've learned a little bit more about Phyllis, why don't we talk about her segments?
So the first appearance by Phyllis Diller, as we mentioned at the beginning, is she walks on stage through a beaded curtain to a piano bar cafe where Rolf is playing. She sits down next to him, and the two of them exchange a series of sort of traditional takedown jokes where each one of them is trying to outdo the other in how bad their life is.
It's just that I'm such a loser.
I know what you mean. I am too.
Do you know, someone gave me a beautiful white mink stole. Within a month, I had developed black dandruff.
So I kept track of how many jokes there were, and then how many of those jokes I thought were funny.
Okay, and you're doing this for both her and Rolf in this?
Yes.
So total jokes were?
14.
Okay.
Funny jokes, 6. Which I felt was actually, because of how back and forth it is, it's a pretty good ratio.
Hardly any of Rolf's worked for me. I'd say by and large, he was definitely the weaker partner.
The only one of his that I liked was the flea collar one.
Hmm. But I would say towards the second half, she had 2 jokes that I definitely glommed onto. I mean, as a follow-up to the statement, I'm such a loser, this didn't work. But as a surrealistic idea towards everything's going wrong in my life, I bought a mink stole and within a month I developed black dandruff was bizarrely ludicrous. Like, that is definitely pushing things to totally unrealistic, and I thought revealed a certain tendency of mine.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed her, the 2 car ones too, about the car she just bought.
The first one I liked a lot, how long it took the car from go to 0 to 60.
I bought one of those expensive new cars that goes from 0 to 60 in 3 hours and 27 minutes.
That was great in that it was very specific, but also totally weird. And so, again, that gave me an idea of the kind of mind that would come up with that as a punchline is somebody that has an element of surprise to their punchlines. Whereas the early stuff of like, I don't like to drink with strangers, hi, I'm Phyllis. Like, that's just very ordinary, banal stuff.
Also, I timed that sketch because the first time I watched it, I once again, similar to the Vincent Price sketch, thought this is going on forever. And it was 3 minutes and 2 seconds. I also included Rolf playing the piano in the intro and the outro as part of music in this episode.
As well you should. What did you think about Phyllis's performance during this? Not the jokes, but her ability to be on stage. Because, first of all, we've already had Fozzie talk about how super special extra it is that she's here. And the premise of this as a wider act is that Rolf's playing the piano in the middle and everybody else is surrounding at their little tables doing their own thing. But as she's talking to Rolf, everybody gets up from their tables and gathers around the piano, and it turns into, effectively, a stand-up in the round. It's basically saying her patter is so magnetic that people would abandon their own company and listen to her.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you think about her as a performer and a presence in this?
I felt like she was doing what she normally does, and she was doing that well. I don't think it worked for the Muppets. We're getting into end of the episode ranking territory.
Okay. I ask because in both this and the talk spot, I felt like she had a hard time being on camera, in that sometimes she was looking directly at the camera. Sometimes she was trying not to. She was aware of the fact that she wasn't supposed to be playing to the audience. She was supposed to be playing to the fictional environment that she was in. And I was thinking about her as a talk show guest and how often when you're on those couches, Sometimes you're talking to Johnny, but sometimes you're talking to the camera and you're talking to the audience at home. And in the talk spot, you can sort of do that same thing. Whereas here, it was a fictional environment. But she was having a hard time not noticing the camera and not playing to the camera, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And therefore, her performance was a little distracted in that sometimes she was focused on communicating with the Muppets in front of her. And sometimes she was in sort of a nebulous studio space and unable to maintain the fiction of what she was doing.
Yeah, she was performing. Whenever she was telling a joke to the audience at home, not to the audience that was surrounding the piano.
She very rarely was talking and delivering her jokes directly to Rolf.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that lack of, boy, this is snobby, but that lack of being in the moment of what she was supposed to be doing for the reality of that scene threw me.
Yeah. Yeah, let's just dive into it rather than me being coy. I ranked her as 24.
Now, you'd had somebody at 24 prior to this, so somebody got bumped up.
Two people got bumped up. I had Harvey Korman at 24 and Joel Grey at 23. So Joel Grey is now 22, Harvey Korman's 23, and Phyllis Diller is now 24. Because I completely agree with everything that you're saying. Like, usually, as we've talked about in all the other episodes, it's connecting with the Muppets and also a little bit of doing something other than what you normally do. And I felt like she just stayed in her comfort zone and, yeah, was performing stand-up on the Muppet Show instead of doing sketches on the Muppet Show.
It's interesting that you're critical of that because the Muppets clearly went out of their way to accommodate this. Of her three segments, not including the wipe, two of those are an opportunity for her to do basically her act. So in conversation with her, in pre-production, they said, all right, Phyllis, what we want you to do is what you do. So the Muppet production and performers didn't want her to break out and do something other than what was predictable. And they created environments for her to be Phyllis Diller in Phyllis Diller land.
Mm-hmm.
But if she had made you laugh, would you have been less critical of that? Or would you have equally been like, she was really funny, but I wanted her to be more than just doing what she did?
Well, I think it's because, like I said, out of the six funny jokes that I counted in that, five of them were hers.
Yeah.
It's that, as you were saying, she wasn't playing to the Muppets. She was playing to the audience.
Mm.
So I didn't feel like she was in the moment there.
So it was less the conceit of the scene and more not really reading the room.
Or not being in the room. She was trying to be at the in the home of the audience. She was not interested, but she wasn't connecting with the Muppets themselves.
How did you feel about her relationship with Fozzie in the talk spot?
Similarly cold.
As I mentioned earlier, we have Fozzie taking the opportunity to grill Phyllis as a great professional comedian. How can he get his act better by learning from the greats? And her premise is that you need to find a stick and stick with it. And so they start off with, this is where she refers to, she makes a fang joke.
Now here's a topic.
Topics.
Fang is so cheap, his idea of a deodorant is to scotch tape a pine cone under each armpit. That's a husband joke.
I can't do that joke.
And Fozzie says, I can't do that because I don't have a husband or a wife. And they go from there into, well, what about an apartment? Because her advice is that you have to have a concept or a bit that you work with.
She basically tells him to make things up, and he refuses to do so.
Yeah.
He says that's a lie.
He likes his audience, and he wants his audience to like him. And in order to do that, they have to be honest with each other, is his feeling.
And she's like, no, just make it up. If it's funny, it's funny.
Which is actually something we've talked a little bit about in the past in terms of stand-up comedians, that there are comedians who are able to maintain a fiction with the audience, but also in these days of social media, you sort of have to, what I've come round to the idea of, and I think you agree with me, but feel free to tell me if I'm misremembering this, is that you sort of have to, unfortunately, live your life on stage because your audience is going to know so much about you. They will reject you if you're clearly doing things where the premise is not based on something they might know about you from a quick Google.
It depends on the comedian. Yeah. If an Anthony Jeselnik, who's writing just one-liner jokes, then he can do whatever he wants. he's not telling stories from his own life or anything like that, but a comedian who's being more of a storyteller, like a Mike Birbiglia, yeah, if you sensed a false premise in that, it would ruin everything that he's built.
But I feel like most comedians are somewhat in the middle, where they're saying, yeah, so my wife gave birth recently, and then they do 5 minutes on, you know, young childhood development. But if they had started that, and you knew from your phone that this person 100% wasn't married, was still playing the field, and had no children.
Oh, yeah.
That's a thing, like, you can't get away with anymore. Whereas if you were in a club in the 80s and the 90s, you could just do child-rearing jokes regardless of if you had children.
Yeah. The middle ground there now is when a comedian says, oh, well, just the other day I was over here or doing this. And it's like, no, you wrote this joke 6 months ago. I'll grant you that.
Sometimes years ago.
Yeah, I can think of one comedian in the past that we've seen multiple times who told the same story and said just the other day every single time we saw it. And we saw him years apart do the same joke.
I do think it's interesting, therefore, that relationship of can you lie to the audience is actually still a legitimate concern that comics might debate about in terms of what can you say and what can't you say, and do you need to be honest, or are you violating that trust, I think is a legitimate conversation to have.
But with Phyllis Diller, like, Fang was fake, but he also wasn't fake, because she would use that as a cover to tell jokes about her husband. But it was a way to protect him from some of it, but also air some of the less taboo dirty laundry. Things that might make him mad, but she could deal with that. Yeah, so I don't give that idea any ill will. Okay. I think that's perfectly sound. It's protecting your loved ones and covering yourself too. It's not complete lying to the audience. It's giving a half truth, which, you know, comedy is comedy. Not everything is always going to be 100% true. It has to be heightened and exaggerated to some extent.
And that's why that kind of a discussion wouldn't have worked as the premise of this exchange, right? You have to lie. Or I can't. You can't deal with the shades of gray
right. In
the comedic premise of this back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Pete.
Yeah.
The joke that Fozzie can't tell.
I live in an apartment so small, the mice are hunchback. No, it's a mice.
No. I got a mouse, but he's not hunchback. He's got the gout.
We've already seen him tell it.
Correct. That joke is in the Joel Grey episode where Fozzie is doing jokes on any subject. He says, small, I live in an apartment so small, the mice are hunchbacked. He, in fact, does it twice. So Phyllis gives him a joke that he's already used on the show, but that he refuses to tell now because it would be dishonest because his mouse has the gout.
Yep, and I just looked it up. That was production episode 3, so...
That's right.
Real
very early.
Early
on. Which also makes me think that is not a Phyllis Diller joke. That's a joke from the writers, and they were cribbing from themselves and assumed nobody would notice.
Although, hold on, let me go back to that for a second. When was this episode recorded?
This episode was recorded between October 11th and 14th of 76.
The Joel Grey episode aired in the U.S. on October 18th.
So it aired basically the week after they recorded this.
Yep. I wonder if they saw that and went, oh no. We also, in talking about comedy, we skipped over the Muppet Newsflash. So let's go back
and talk
about that for a moment.
In the Muppet Newsflash, the Muppet Newsman brings on Phyllis Diller because she has achieved a remarkable feat of flying from Mobile, Alabama to Dallas, Texas with a pair of wings that she has designed herself.
So they then introduce Phyllis Diller as Beverly Shepherd.
Whose hair is insane.
Another Phyllis Diller staple.
Oh, is it?
Yep, she would regularly have wild hair on stage. Yeah, she describes the wings. She stapled aluminum foil to something and then covered it in chicken feathers.
But she seems confused. She's like, is this really going out on the news? What did I do that was so astonishing, she says.
And then I strapped those on, got on a plane, and flew to Dallas.
And the Muppet Newsman basically collapses in a heap and is like, ugh. I can't believe that this is going out on the air.
But again, basically, this was just Phyllis Diller talking to the camera because they were in separate places. She was, like, down the barrel. So again, no real connection to Muppets. There wasn't really much back and forth either. He kind of set her up, she goes off, and then he reacts.
I thought she was great, though. Like, speaking about not necessarily being in the moment in the Rolf segment, she was very much in character in this bit. Like, she was absolutely committed to this as bit. And I thought she was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't much of a joke, but that's also what I liked about it, is that it was a dumb joke. Yeah. And she was part of the, wait, this is a joke? Like, that was sort of her performance. Whereas the wipe that she does with Gonzo is very much a one-line gag. It's a setup, knock-em-down punchline, and she's real excited about how bad of a joke that is.
Yeah, he's admiring her camera, and
she says, yeah, it's a great pocket camera. And she pulls out some Polaroids to show him.
And they are pictures of her pockets. It's a good bit.
And she's hooping and hollering, as you say, one of her trademarks.
Mm-hmm.
So her final segment then, as you mentioned in the trivia, is her playing saxophone
to the song The Entertainer with the Muppet Orchestra accompanying.
And I mentioned in my answer that she played the saxophone very badly. Mm-hmm. And this is the essential joke here, is that the whole Muppet Orchestra, something that we haven't, to my knowledge, seen referred to as such before, has the Electric Mayhem in the traditional maroon jackets with Rolf at the piano and a couple of other instrumentalists poked in around.
Yeah.
And she's out in front in a dress playing sax. The Entertainer, of course, a traditional, I say traditional, it's from 1902, a ragtime jazz piano arrangement, but it's being done here on sax. And she starts off okay, but within the second 8 bars of music, she is squawking and squeaking, and every time she wanders around the notes, Rolf looks more and more anxious about what's going on.
She's having a blast. She thinks she's killing it. I thought she was overdoing it, but I also appreciated it. Like, this was the one time where she really worked for me, because it wasn't her just doing jokes. She was really hamming it up, and I liked that. The only thing that she did that didn't work for me was when the reed gets stuck to her tongue.
Mm.
That was the one bit that I was like, no, I don't like that. But all the other physical bits she did, I was totally on board with.
And then Zoot comes in and joins her, and she's blowing on the sax in a way to sort of aggressively toot him out of joining in with her. There's sort of a back and forth.
There's a dueling saxes.
Yes, yes, well said. Before he eventually gives up and leaves her to finish, where it's just a escalation of the wrong note up and up and up the scale until she finally squawks out the final correct pitch. I thought it was interesting. I don't know if it was the speed at which Zoot had to play and stop playing opposite her, but this was really the first time that I noticed that Zoot wasn't really up to par in terms of miming the sax. Or maybe it was just that he was standing next to a person who was actually playing sax, even though she was playing it badly. Now, again, oftentimes this is done to a recording. And so I don't know for certain that she was actually playing sax.
Mm-hmm.
But
it sure looked like it, though.
It did to me. I was watching, and it seemed like notes were being made in conjunction, split second, with the fingering that she was doing.
Mm-hmm.
So it felt like she was doing it live while everything else was a recording.
I also feel like she got red by the end. Like she was blowing and straining to make these notes, which made me think that she was actually doing it.
So let's operate under the assumption that she was really playing. It made Zoot suffer by comparison. That Zoot may look good performing to a track when Dave Goles has had the opportunity to figure out the miming. But when he's next to somebody who's actually playing, except your face says you didn't think he didn't look good.
No, I was still loving watching Zoot toot on that sax.
Well, she hits the final wrong note. Rolf wipes sweat from his brow. And we conclude the episode with Kermit in front of the curtain introducing, as is not atypical, Phyllis walking out in an outfit totally unlike anything she's worn for the previous bit. The final curtain call outfits are a constant mystery to me. This one was no exception. Kermit says, is there anything I can do in exchange for such a lovely performance? She says, well, do you mind actually standing over here? And then she gestures Fozzie on. He has the trapdoor rope pull from the opening. And he pulls it and Kermit disappears below the stage, which a yelp that you consider to have been better than Frank's at the beginning.
I didn't say that.
Oh, I understand now.
I said there was a trapdoor later.
That you thought was better.
Uh-huh.
I get it. I've clued in now.
And then Fozzie also falls down the trapdoor after saying, see you next time on The Muppet Show.
At which point everyone gathers around to peer down the hole at the two missing performers and to wave goodbye. And then the final moment of Statler and Waldorf in the box is that Waldorf says, I loved it.
And then Statler's holding his own rope and pulls it, and Waldorf falls down the trapdoor and says,
oh, I hated it!
It's not unusual for the Statler and Waldorf to have picked up a thread from earlier, but usually it's their own internal universe. Like, they're in the final bit, they'll sometimes refer to something else they've done.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really fun to see them interacting with the continuity of what was going on stage instead of their own little private moments. I really liked that action.
Yeah, it was good. It's also not unusual for them to be loved by anyone.
You may eventually cure me of using that phrase if you keep that up. As always, it is a commonplace practice and not at all a strange thing for us to end each episode with stats. We've already done our ranking, but we have other things that Pete tracks. Kisses, explosions, wigs, and various other accoutrements that we have been following over the course of the season. Pete, what statistics do we need to have remembered?
There were 5 explosions in this episode. 1 human Muppet kiss. She kisses Rolf at the depressing thing.
At the Sadness Cafe.
Yes. Ooh, Sadness Cafe. I like that. And there was 1 1-2-3 dip. As for music, there was 10 minutes and 24 seconds worth of music out of 26 minutes and 22 seconds worth of show for 39.44% music.
I was going to say, that sounds like not up to our normal 40%.
Yeah, it's kind of right in the middle. It's probably fairly middle road.
Unremarkable, but slim.
Yeah. And since she didn't do any music, but she played the saxophone.
But she does.
But usually the guest sings a song or something. There's only been a few times where there's been absolutely no guest music. And this was almost one of those cases.
Well, then let us plunge merrily into our top 5 moments. Since you were responsible for the trivia, I will start this week. And since you mentioned it in the explosions, because my thought was, wait, 5 explosions? I realized that you were counting each of Dr. Bunsen Honeydew's earmuffs as a separate explosion.
Yep.
During that sketch, specifically after the exploding earmuffs, Dave Goals has Bunsen do a woohoo when the headphones go. That is so delightful.
For those who want the daring double-barreled effect, exploding earmuffs.
I was in awe this episode of some of the versatility of the Muppet performers. Specifically, this didn't come up earlier in conversation, but I only just realized that Jerry Nelson is the voice of the announcer in Vets Hospital.
Mm.
And specifically for that voice, that sonorous, deep, after having heard him do the You Are My Sunshine alien in that squeaky, charmy voice, I was really impressed with his range, but Dr. Bunsen Honeydew is such a weird, goofy, bubbly, lighthearted swing away from Gonzo. And the way in which he says the woohoo was so delightful and so wonderful and so charming. I don't think I've really ever heard gulls do anything in that register before. It was hilarious anyway, but it was also hilarious as knowing that that's part of his wider repertoire.
I'm glad you brought this up because going back to our earlier discussion about Muppet Labs, about how you didn't remember this one.
Yeah.
It's because in your Nickelodeon rewatches, this Muppet Labs was cut.
Oh. Because of the potential violence?
I assume so. They didn't want kids putting explosions around their heads or fireworks on their heads. So.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. For my moment, I'm going to go to something that you mentioned earlier, but we didn't touch on what I loved about it, which was when the Gogolala Jubilee Jug Band come off stage. Kermit is trying to get to Scooter, but there's so many members of the band that he's essentially trying to swim upstream through the members of the band and just struggling with every subsequent member. And it was so fun to watch that happen.
Yeah, it was just sort of silent business while Scooter is talking and he can't make it through the maelstrom of Hicks that are creating backstage. I mean, we don't actually have any dialogue from Kermit in that scene, do we? Doesn't he just get carried away?
I don't remember.
Kermit's not in that backstage segment at all. It's Hilda and Scooter, and then Fozzie comes on.
Yeah, that might be the only thing he has, because, yeah, afterwards Scooter chases after them because of their muddy feet, yep, and then sees Hilda by the stairs.
And so it's just there for people watching the background. In the talk spot, when Fozzie tells the joke where he's got it, and he tells the joke about how his mouse has the gout, and he's like,
"That's funny. It's funny. It is funny." Oh, please laugh. Please.
And the transformation from him delivering the joke to watching Phyllis's non-reaction to crumbling into a pit of self-despair as he collapses on her shoulder and starts basically wailing in that he's never going to be funny.
He does a 40-year pre-Jeb Bush because he says, "Oh, please laugh," instead of "please clap."
He does. He literally says it. But actually, it's a fairly subtle performance. Like, it's not as outré as the "please don't heckle me" that he does with Kermit, but it's basically the same idea. And I don't know, I really, really appreciated that performance. It wasn't straight to maniacal weeping. It was sort of a slower, fainter, sadder realization that what he thought he'd understood about learning from the master, he'd totally whiffed on.
Yep.
And I really thought it was highly, finely tuned.
I also had that moment bolded on my notes, so I'm very glad you picked it. For my final moment, I have, on the same theme as my first moment, a background business of the backstage.
Interesting.
In the third backstage moment, when she's got the hair and lipstick on, George walks past her and has a shocked reaction to seeing her. And I loved it. It made me laugh so hard when I noticed it the second time.
I don't think I noticed that at all.
Yeah, he's coming off stage. I don't remember why or if there's a reason that he is. But yeah, he's walking from off stage past her and he does a double take. And when he notices that it's Hilda, like, his mouth opens and he, like, shock reacts to it. And when I clocked it, it made me react exactly as you're reacting right now.
See, that's very interesting to me, because I was planning on doing my final moment was to focus in on specifically what Frank did to upstage as Piggy in Vet's Hospital, which means that most of our stuff, this is Frank performance during our five favorite moments, but two of them are things where Frank didn't actually have anything specific to do, but was just like, "I need to pull focus here. I need to be funny." Because what Piggy does in Vet's Hospital specifically is when the voiceover is happening. That's when she's draping herself over Dr. Bob, laughing laughing so hard she falls down below the gurney.
Slapping him on the back.
She's doing so much when she literally has nothing to do in the scene and therefore is just like, look at me, I'm doing something here. I loved it the first time, but it was the second time that I watched that I realized that it was being done because Piggy wasn't doing anything in the scene. And I was like, yeah, Frank's just like, no, I'm not going to have any of this.
Yeah, if I'm going to be here, I'm going to be Frank Oz. This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design, such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. The theme song is from archival Henson Associates clips of Sylvester and Cone's Yes, We Have No Bananas, under what we hope is transformative fair use, much as the Hensons did when they first broadcast as Salmon Friends.
You can find us at firstperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @firstnamebasis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomenon.
There are things, dates, facts, names, the legacy of Tin Pan Alley musicians, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect. Please contact us via the website and we will post it to our errata page on farceperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete, my co-host is Ben.
I hated it!
And we'll see you next time when we discuss production episode 22, guest starring Ethel Merman. Yay!